Major funding for The Pulse is provided by a leadership gift from the Sutherland family. The Sutherlands support WHYY and its commitment to the production of programs that improve our quality of life.
This is The Pulse, stories about the people and places at the heart of health and science. I'm Mike and Scott. At the end of March, Nanjo Guo's work was about to change dramatically. She's a nurse practitioner in the pulmonary unit at Temple University Hospital in Philadelphia. Patients with coronavirus were starting to come in, and Nanjo knew she was going to care for them. Her husband wanted her to quit her job, but she refused.
I can't say, no, I'm not going back, because there won't be enough medical providers for these patients. And it's a career I chose.
But she also didn't want to expose her family to the infection risk. So she decided to go to work and not come home for as long as it would take. She kissed her three little kids goodbye and she told them,
Mommy has to go to war. It's like the war. You know, if Mommy is okay, Mommy can come home.
She moved into an empty college dorm near her hospital and settled in.
The mattress isn't the nicest, as there's a curvature in the middle, and all of them are like that. I guess it's due to use, but I'm getting used to it.
Around that same time, nurse and former hospital CEO Sandra Gomberg realized just how dire things were getting. She was teaching an online nursing class, and one of her students was working at a hospital in New York City.
And she logged on, and she had her head in her hands, and her eyes were full of tears, and her face, she was exhausted. And I said to her, my goodness, are you okay? And she said, yes. 10 patients died today. And the grief in her voice and the concern for her staff's well-being was so powerful to me. I felt it in my heart. And so when I got this call, and my husband said, are you crazy?
The call was for Sandra to lead a major initiative to care for patients with COVID-19.
I said, look, these nurses and these nurse leaders that I have the privilege to work with in class didn't have a choice. COVID hit them and they couldn't run away. And they are suffering through this. And so if I have been asked to step up, I don't have a choice but to step up.
During the pandemic, nurses have been taking charge of lots of different aspects of the outbreak. Caring for patients, communicating with their families, leading hospitals, creating guidelines and public health messages, helping businesses or schools stay safe. And in many ways, this is a reflection of the changing roles of nurses in a broader sense. What nurses do and get involved in has expanded dramatically in the past decades.
I am a registered nurse.
I predominantly worked in emergency departments.
I am a nurse case manager.
I'm a maternal child float nurse.
I'm a registered nurse on a neurology neurosurgery unit.
A lot of my teaching has been about psychiatric mental health nursing.
I'm a nurse and a nurse manager.
Today's episode is about nursing, new responsibilities and challenges, and how they affect the work of nurses and patient care. So Sandra Gomberg got a call that basically asked her to step up to a major challenge. Turn a 10,000-seat sports arena at Philadelphia's Temple University into a field hospital, as an overflow facility should all of the city's ICU units fill up. And she said yes.
When we got there, there were some large packing boxes that were sent from the Pennsylvania Emergency Management Group that had some supplies and equipment in it, like cots and paper sheets and things that you would use in a really extreme emergency.
Sandra led a team of about 200 staff and volunteers. They had less than 2 weeks to set up this entire operation from scratch.
Were you just working around the clock? Like, I'm just imagining your cell phone going off every 2 seconds and everybody yelling your name and things just moving in a thousand directions.
My cell phone went off for many hours of the day and into the night, and people called my name often. They were good 16-hour days for those 14 days of getting prepared. In addition, there were certain specialized vendors and staff who did work around the clock. So we had many of the facilities folks who were setting up oxygen or electric, housekeeping. Those folks did work around the clock, but the rest of the folks were there about 12 to 16 hours a day during the setup.
You've had a long career in this field, and you have been a leader in the field. What aspects of your previous career prepared you for this? This was uncharted territory in many ways.
Yes, it was. So at a fundamental level, I'm a nurse, and no matter how high in the administrative chain of command you rise to, you always see through a nurse's eyes. And so that ability to intuitively know what's in the best interest of the patient and keeping the staff safe permeates down to the clinical bedside care, but also allows me to cross-check the more strategic and tactical administrative decisions I made. So that nursing background in particular was my anchor and foundation.
Sandra said while running the field hospital, her leadership and disaster management training came into play.
But in the end, I think that the most critical skill set that nurses and leaders alike need to have is the ability to think strategically and tactically almost in the same second, so that we were thinking about what could be the surge in the city and what that strategy would be like, and making the decision about how best to deliver oxygen.
Do you have a sort of mantra or anything that is a sentence you say to yourself? Like, I don't know, sometimes I say to myself, one thing at a time, one thing at a time, when I'm feeling overwhelmed. Like, do you have anything like that?
Well, I have a kind of a set of guiding principles that I've always worked around, and they are always put the patient in the center, treat people with dignity and respect, come from a place of curiosity, and remember that money always follows quality, not the other way around. And I always come back to that when I am faced in big challenges like this, to help ground me and make sure I'm paying attention to the right priorities at the right time.
Was there a moment that felt particularly stressful, anything that stands out where you thought, oh my goodness, we're not going to get this hospital ready in time?
There was any time you are doing kind of an urgent startup, if you will, there is a lot of chaos going on, but it's positive chaos. Everybody is doing any job that's needed, but there comes a point where that chaos becomes overlapping. People are conflicting with each other. Two teams find they're working on the same thing, and it gets a little stressful and chaotic in not the most constructive way. And when that happened, we called all of the teams together, and we called a timeout, and we talked about what our charge was and what it meant to put the patient in the center and keep the staff safe. Those conversations with the whole team, being really transparent and acknowledging their hard work, kind of reset everybody. And the rest of that day, there was literally silence. Everybody had their head down, and everybody was moving forward. And I knew that when we got the team to transition from the beehive of activity to kind of that quiet attention to every detail, I knew that we were going to meet the deadline we were given.
Sandra Gomberg led an effort to build a coronavirus surge facility at Temple University's Leah Kouros Center. The city of Philadelphia did not face a surge of patients in the spring, and the field hospital closed in May. But Sandra says it's ready to go should the numbers go up in the fall. We're talking about the changing roles of nurses, right now looking at the work of nurses during the pandemic. Over the last few months, hospitals all over the country have handled coronavirus spikes, with very sick and dying patients quickly filling up emergency rooms and ICU beds. Kate O'Connell experienced one of these surges up close. She is an ER nurse in New York City and also an audio producer. In March, she began documenting her experience on the front lines of the outbreak. Her recording became part of a series from Transom called Pandemic ER, Notes from a Nurse in Queens. Let's listen to this excerpt.
It's been very, very hairy at work. I am seeing things I cannot believe. It's like we're running a MASH unit, but without the blood and guts. It's all airway, airway, airway. When I left work today after seeing the next shift coming on, I looked at all my colleagues just hustling. It's just now getting easier to recognize each other as we are all wearing N95 respirator masks covered by paper surgical masks all day. And I felt such absolute tenderness for everyone. I felt like, hey, be safe. I want to see you again. There is nothing worse, nothing for me as a nurse, than to see a person struggling to breathe and to listen to the docs telling them, we may need to protect your airway. This involves sedating you and putting a tube down your windpipe and letting a ventilator do the work of breathing for a while. And they're just looking at you terrified. They can't talk because they can barely breathe. Their eyes say it all. Our ER has been divided into areas as best they can, with the non-COVID area getting smaller by the minute. Today, our entire critical hallway, all the trauma rooms, the regular ER, the fast track area, the observation area, were all just sick COVID patients who need oxygen and monitoring, several of whom are vented and waiting for ICU beds. Ideally, if we can stabilize a person on a non-rebreather 100% O2 mask or with BiPAP and prevent intubation and venting, that is a win. Our hospital's giant two-story lobby has been transformed into a fever clinic, where people get a COVID test and are educated, lectured, about how to manage symptoms at home. They are the walking well. They may be sick and febrile, but they should be okay at home. The area where we're seeing non-COVID emergency patients is an old ER waiting room, tricked out with recliners, stretchers, and room dividers. So I had a guy who was crushed by an 800-pound piece of elevator machinery today. He's okay, a bright spot in a sea of misery. People still need the ER for those kinds of emergencies, heart attacks, strokes, seizures, etc. We have a nurse outside doing initial triage on people coming in by car or walking. She splits the flow. If they have COVID symptoms and can walk, they go to the fever clinic. If they are unlikely to have COVID or here for an obvious non-COVID emergency, they go to the old waiting room. If they have COVID or high suspicion of COVID and they're short of breath, they go to the main ER. As I left work today, I heard the second overhead call within 10 minutes, 10, about a notification arriving. That's when EMS is phoned ahead to alert us to a critical patient on the way. I passed by the room where the first one went. An intubation was already in progress, and I saw EMS come flying in with the second note. And I just looked at my manager like, do you need me to stay? She said, go, just go, but please come back. I'm back in tomorrow, and math being math-like, it will be exponentially worse. I'm sad to see so many really sick patients, and I have a new fearful sadness of seeing my colleagues being overwhelmed and unable to do their best work because the circumstances just will not allow it. These are complicated feelings. XOXO, Cato.
That was ER nurse Kate O'Connell documenting her experiences in March of this year. Together with Samantha Brown from Transom, Kate has produced an audio series called Pandemic ER, Notes from a Nurse in Queens. We'll put a link on our website at whyy.org/thepulse. I asked Sandra Gomberg, the nursing leader I spoke with earlier, about some of the lessons that may come out of this pandemic for the field of nursing. And she said the kind of stress Kate just described will be one of the things the field has to tackle. How do you deal with that? And how can nurses heal from this experience?
The shifts were long. Many of the nurses got sick themselves and had to take care of themselves and their families. So it was a very confusing and overwhelming time. And what we've learned is that the power of nurses to support their peers, both their families and the families of their colleagues, the profession of nursing needs to continue to address the aftermath of those really complicated experiences. Nurses are very tired. They need to recover both physically, emotionally, and mentally. And as we look to the fall, we need to make sure that we've added into our nursing support the time and attention to address those stressors and figure out new ways to deliver care to give the nurses on the front line a break. Probably one of the most powerful things I read recently was a story about a senior nurse like me, who's not at the bedside any longer, but certainly very passionately a nurse. And one of the younger nurses who she had mentored along the way reached out to her during the pandemic. And that mentor relationship, just someone who understood what it meant to be at the bedside and someone who understood the challenges and the decisions that she had to make at the bedside, made all the difference in her resiliency and her ability to channel that frustration and meet her own personal needs. And I think that for nurse leaders is incredibly important. You know, while we are one of the most trusted professions in the world, we need to recognize that we can also be the most trusted colleagues and mentors for each other. And I think that the senior nurses and the nurse leaders need to really call upon that responsibility and privilege in order to mentor and support the young nurses.
That's Sandra Gomberg. She is a longtime nurse and a nursing educator. If you want to know just how much nursing has changed in recent decades, talk to a family with several generations of nurses.
Okay, my name is Wanda Bamudu.
Wanda's mom, Ella Nicholson, started working as a pediatric nurse in the 60s.
African-American nurses couldn't even carry stethoscopes. And I remember she said that she had saved money and bought herself a stethoscope. And there was a white charge nurse who was going to take it from her because she was not supposed to have it. And she told her, no, I bought this. You know, I remember my mother, it took her 7 years to get her associate degree, but she stuck with it.
And watching her mom work with persistence and dedication, Wanda realized she wanted to follow in her footsteps.
You know, I just loved everything about what she did. I loved the care that she showed. My heart was just to be a nurse. That was all I knew I wanted to do, nothing else.
Wanda has been a registered nurse since the late 80s.
I just love the profession, hence why I passed it down to my daughter.
So.
That's a nice transition.
Yes, it was.
That's Wanda's daughter, Ashley Aloba, the third generation nurse in this family. She's been a registered nurse since 2015, and she works in the same hospital system as Wanda, in a transplant unit.
We do abdominal organ transplants, so kidneys, livers, pancreases. We just did our two successful uterus transplants, and then we do hands as well.
And Wanda, what are some of the changes you see when you look at your daughter and what she's doing and how her workplace functions?
I watch her and I look at the professionalism that she maintains, some of the leadership opportunities at the bedside, and those are some of the things that have definitely changed over the years. They are really exercising their power as nurses, their knowledge base as nurses, and really stretching it.
Wanda says when she first started out in the field 30-some years ago, things were very different.
You know, I just think back and I think about how empowered I think I feel my daughter is. And I just feel like I wish that at her age, because, you know, we became nurses quite maybe about the same age, but I don't feel that I was as strong of a person as she has been.
But do you think the setting back then was also different, where maybe had you shown that kind of leadership, it might not have gone over well, or people would have said, stay in your lane.
Stay in your lane, right. Yeah, that's probably, you know, it was definitely a hierarchy. And there was a charge nurse. The charge nurse pretty much managed the schedule, and they may give input to the doctor as for what's going on, but they didn't do a lot of the problem solving that goes on now.
Wanda says her mother, Ella, is blown away by the changes in nursing, all of the opportunities that have opened up in this profession.
So to see myself advance and then to see her granddaughter advance, it's, you know, she's very proud. And she said, I never would have thought nursing would go this way.
Wanda thinks her daughter's generation of nurses has just so many more options.
I just see the world is endless in nursing.
And Ashley agrees.
Yeah, I felt like when I became a nurse, I could do anything. So I really do feel like nurses are going to just extend their branches into a lot of other avenues, whether it be law, whether it be business. I mean, the opportunities are endless.
That's Ashley Aloba with her mother, Wanda Bermudu. Even as nurses take on lots of new responsibilities, they are still the main eyes and ears on the ground with patient care, says nursing historian Patricia D'Antonio.
Nurses have often been described as the patient's both first and last line of defense. They are the clinicians that have the most experience with the patient. We're the ones that are able to recognize when things may not be going right.
All of the demands that nurses juggle can become overwhelming. So how many patients should a nurse have at any given moment? Nurses and their employers have been fighting about that question across the country. And there's a push for policies and laws to regulate nurse-to-patient ratios. For example, in 2018, Massachusetts had a law like this on the ballot. It was called the Patient Safety Act. Hospital groups spent a lot of money, $25 million, on ads against this law. And in the end, the legislation lost by a landslide. 70% of Massachusetts voters were against it. Why are these nurse-to-patient ratios so controversial? Reporter Liz Tung went to find out.
It was a busy night at the Chicago area ER, where Melissa Bertoletti worked. As usual, she was the only triage nurse on duty. It was her job to single-handedly keep admissions flowing by assessing and prioritizing each and every patient who came through the door. The ER was already crowded when a woman in her 40s, along with her husband, came in.
The woman was having back pain, kind of side pain. We call it flank.
Melissa checked her vitals and had her sit. It was swamped that day, which meant for any non-emergency patients, it was going to be a wait. So Melissa turned back to admissions. But after a while,
the lady came up to the desk with the husband again, and she said, I can't take the pain anymore. The pain is excruciating. So I called in the back to try to get her a room right away because they had already been waiting, you know, 1 or 2 hours.
But as Melissa was making the call, a new patient came in, and he did not look good.
He came in clutching his chest. He was gray. He had beads of sweat on his nose. I knew he was in trouble.
As in, she knew he was having a heart attack. So Melissa rushed to try and get him a bed. But when she got back, she found the woman who'd been complaining about side pain lying on the floor.
You know, that woman died. She died. She died waiting in the emergency room.
Melissa later found out the woman had what's called an aortic dissection, meaning her heart basically exploded in her chest.
I felt defeated because I went to nursing school to help people and to save lives. And I feel like I failed that woman. I mean, she was somebody's mother, obviously a wife, somebody's sister. But I really feel if there was another nurse up front with me, we could have reassessed her, but there was no other nurse to help me.
What Melissa went through is something thousands of nurses across the country deal with on a daily basis: short staffing. A survey of nurses conducted in 2018 found that only 20% of nurses in the U.S. feel like their staffing levels are safe. And in recent years, this has pushed nurses to take to the streets.
We are in a moment of crisis.
More than 10,000 nurses in New York threatened to strike over staffing issues.
We need a contract with safe staffing ratios. Thank you, NYSRA, for all you do.
A few months later, thousands more in California, Illinois, Florida, and Arizona launched their own coordinated strikes. And their number one demand was better nurse-to-patient ratios.
We filed over 1,700 reports of unsafe staffing in the last 18 months.
Ratios do indeed improve patient outcomes, save money, save lives.
Doris Carroll is one of the co-founders of the group Nurses Take DC. It's a grassroots group that advocates for mandated nurse-to-patient ratios. It's an idea that nurses' unions have spent years fighting for, mostly without success. The one exception being California. They passed a ratios law in 1999 that limited each nurse to no more than 4 patients at once, though the exact number can fluctuate depending on the unit. But in other states, there is no safety cap. And some nurses complain that they're handling as many as 8 or 10 or even more patients at once. And Doris says that is a huge safety issue.
Nurses' number one duty to a patient is to be the patient advocate. And when we say it's unsafe at the bedside, it's unsafe. We're not making this up, and we have research to back us up.
It seems like a common sense idea, but across the country, it's faced a lot of resistance. So what is the argument against ratios? To find out, I called up Danny Chun. He's a spokesman for the Illinois Health and Hospital Association, which is Illinois' leading hospital advocacy group. Here's what he had to say about ratios.
It's a deeply flawed, inflexible, rigid approach to setting staffing levels that does not improve quality, safety, or outcomes, but in fact would adversely affect patients.
The group Danny works for has been very publicly against nurse-patient ratios, specifically against a proposed Illinois law that would set limits on how many patients a nurse gets assigned. Danny says the law could have some serious unintended consequences, including, he says, less health care to go around. Basically, the crux of his argument is we already don't have enough nurses. If we start limiting the care our nurses can give, we're going to have to ration care, turn people away. Or, worst case scenario,
hospitals close, including small hospitals in rural areas of the state and safety net hospitals in urban areas.
But one of the biggest arguments that the hospital industry makes against mandated ratios is that there's simply no proof that they work.
The evidence is not conclusive that ratios improved quality, safety, or outcomes.
The hospital industry's spent millions of dollars on anti-ratio ads, so it might be tempting to dismiss Danny's arguments as corporate spin. But Doris, the co-founder of Nurses Take DC, told me the debate is a lot more complicated.
Well, actually, you'd be quite surprised who the other organization that's opposed to mandated ratios, and that would be our very own professional organization, the American Nurses Association.
So, you know, I don't want to say we oppose ratios. I want to say our approach is different.
That's Janet Habler. She's a policy director at the American Nurses Association. And she says the idea that they're against ratios, it's a myth. But they do oppose making laws about ratios.
We're opposed to legislated ratios. It would require going back to the legislature to change the numbers when an adjustment is needed. We support flexibility and the individual units within a facility, no less each unit, staffing to what works for them.
What I gathered from talking to Janet is that their problem with mandated ratios is the lack of flexibility. They say it doesn't take into account a whole host of factors, like how experienced a nurse is or the needs of specific patients. Instead, the American Nurses Association supports an approach where committees of nurses decide what staffing should look like. Ideally, Janet says those decisions should take into account way more factors than I have time to get into here. But one important factor that kind of captures the idea is what's called patient acuity. That's where instead of fixed numbers of patients, nurses' assignments change based on their patients' needs.
For instance, let's say you work on a maternity ward and all of your moms and newborn babies are healthy. They'd be considered low acuity and you could handle more of them at once. On the other hand, if you've got a mom and baby who are sick and in need of constant supervision, they'd be high acuity and they might be your only patients for the day. So with acuity, ratios can change based on need. But here's the problem with flexible standards. As it turns out, they're kind of hard to enforce. So where does that leave nurses? One option, of course, is to complain. But fear of retaliation is something I heard about again and again. And one nurse I talked to, Julie Griffin, had a story that explained why. Julie's a registered nurse from Florida, a 25-year veteran, who's currently suing her former hospital.
I had brought it to their attention numerous times that the unit I worked on was unsafe and it was also against the law to bill Medicare. And that's when they took it to the next level and they terminated me.
In order to get Medicare money, hospitals have to follow certain rules. And one of them is that in the intensive care unit, nurses should be assigned no more than 2 patients each. But in the cardiovascular ICU where Julie worked, she says nurses were routinely assigned upwards of 3, sometimes 5 or 6 patients during lunch. So Julie started filing complaints, first to her supervisor and then going up the chain. But at least as far as Julie saw, nothing changed. It all came to a head one day when Julie says her supervisor again asked her to take on a 3rd patient in violation of Medicare regulations. And this time, Julie refused.
I didn't want to take the 3rd patient because there was a risk of losing my license.
Or, she says, of missing something that could lead to the death or injury of a patient. In response, Julie was disciplined for, quote, insubordination, refusal to accept patient assignment. Shortly after that, she was fired. I reached out to Julie's former hospital, Westside Regional Medical Center in Florida, and they answered with a statement, quote, when there is an issue that could potentially affect patient care, we will take action and we are very comfortable with the decision to terminate this individual. A lot of nurses I talked to describe being stuck with similar impossible choices. Either take the assignments and risk harming a patient or possibly losing their license, or refuse and potentially lose their jobs. The question is, are mandated ratios the answer? To find out, I turned to someone who knows the research on nurse staffing probably better than anyone, Linda Aiken.
I am a professor at the University of Pennsylvania School of Nursing and direct the Center for Health Outcomes and Policy Research.
Linda has done decades of research on how nurse staffing affects patients and how hospital policies affect nurses. I started off asking her about some of the arguments I'd heard. For example, that there's no evidence that staffing ratios improve patient outcomes.
No, that's not true. I respectfully disagree, and we have very good evidence that not only in the U.S. but in other countries that have adopted nurse-to-patient ratios, that staffing has improved and patient outcomes have improved as a result.
Specifically, they've been seeing fewer complications, fewer infections, fewer injuries. And get this factoid. Linda says nurse staffing is the single most important factor that we can control when it comes to patient mortality. I asked her why nurses seem to be so important when it comes to saving patients' lives. Linda said it's because nurses are basically the first line of defense in healthcare. They're the ones who spot and prevent complications before they happen.
Whether you can survive a cardiac arrest depends upon how fast someone sees that you've had one and can call help to come in. And it's all nurses. It's all driven by nurses.
Which brings me to a question that has maybe played the central role for people who oppose ratios. Could they cause hospitals to close? Or cost a spike, or community health programs to lose all their nurses? Linda's looked at the evidence in California. They've had a ratio law since 1999, and more recently, Australia. They've had a law since 2015.
No hospitals closed because they couldn't get nurses, and no other part of the healthcare system was impacted either, like nursing homes. No access to care problems, no emergency rooms closing. No consumer paid any more money as a result of this legislation that required hospitals to staff in an evidence-based way.
And then Linda told me something that really surprised me.
There are plenty of nurses. We have no nursing shortage in our country.
It seems like every year we see headlines about nursing shortages on the horizon. It's like the boogeyman for people who oppose ratios. They say the shortage is why we have staffing problems in the first place, and also why ratios would just make things worse. Linda says it's true that some places have shortages, but as a country, we've got plenty of nurses.
There isn't enough nursing care in a lot of hospitals, but that's not because there's a nursing shortage, it's because the hospitals are not employing enough nurses.
At the bottom of all of this, of course, is money. The hospital industry says employing the extra nurses needed to meet ratios would be impossibly expensive. And let's not forget, hospitals are a business. That's something the older nurses I talked to say has become increasingly clear over the past few decades. But it turns out ratios might not be that bad for hospitals' bottom lines. Linda and other researchers have found that they could actually save money because nurses prevent expensive things like patient infections and injuries.
Money is saved because if people don't come back to the hospital, you can literally save millions of dollars.
Linda is the first to say that ratios are not the end-all, be-all of nurse staffing. For instance, she says acuity is super important to take into account.
In setting these ratios, the purpose is not to say what the ideal is or what the staffing should be. It's to set a minimum.
In other words, ratios are not a silver bullet. What they offer is a starting point.
That story was reported by Liz Tong. We're talking about how the nursing profession is changing, some of the challenges nurses face, but also new opportunities that are opening up. Nursing historian Patricia D'Antonio told me one track that is growing rapidly is nurse practitioner.
This idea that nurses can assess, diagnose, and treat many more common forms or more chronic forms of an illness experience.
So in many ways, they function more like physicians. We heard from a nurse practitioner who told us about their work.
Hi, my name is Chance Krampaski, and I use the pronouns he and him. I am based in Brooklyn, New York.
Chance works at a community health center.
I provide primary care, endoscopy services, and genital health care, family planning for trans folks. I would say that the most rewarding part of my job is being able to be a healthcare provider who serves folks in my own communities. So in the queer communities, in trans communities, I would say that the most challenging part of my job is I have a lot of patients and it really pains me to see them struggling with getting medical services that are necessary to their health covered. Around trans health and also HIV.
We're talking about the changing work of nurses and coming up, teaching nurses how to collect forensic evidence.
When I first started in the emergency department as the rookie, they handed me the box and the paperwork and said, follow the directions.
That's still to come on The Pulse.
Support for The Pulse comes from Select Greater Philadelphia. With over 30 cell and gene therapy development companies, Greater Philadelphia is where the field started and continues to thrive. More at discoverystartshere.com.
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at pennmedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
This is The Pulse. I'm Mike and Scott. We're talking about how the work of nurses is changing. They are taking on new roles, creating new specialties. For example, nurses can play a key role in the initial treatment and care of sexual assault victims in emergency rooms. They are providing treatment and care for victims while also collecting evidence that could then be used in future criminal prosecutions. But in many parts of the country, ER nurses are not trained to do this job. One hospital in rural Pennsylvania is turning to telehealth consultations from experts to support both nurses and victims. Stephanie Marudas reports, and a warning, this story does contain details related to sexual assault.
There's only one hospital in the small town of Wellsboro, Pennsylvania, and it's the main one for the entire county. It's a red brick building designed to blend in with the surrounding architecture of Wellsboro's downtown, where there are independent businesses and charming historic gas lights. But once you leave town, it becomes rural. There are rolling hills, sprawling forests, and winding roads. And sometimes people travel an hour or more to get to the hospital. Laura Coates started working there as a nurse 10 years ago. And one day, a sexual assault victim came in.
When I first started in the emergency department as the rookie, they handed me the box and the paperwork and said, follow the directions.
Laura didn't have any formal training with sexual assault cases at all.
So I went in and did it, followed the directions, you know, and did it, I think, a fair job. But we don't do them that often. Maybe there'll be 10 cases in a whole year for the whole entire ER. But when those cases come, it's usually when we're busy, and the victim would have to sit in the quiet room and wait till a nurse could be freed up for the couple of hours it takes to do a good job collecting.
Sometimes victims just left and Laura would pick up the phone the next day.
So I would call them and ask them, come back in. At least let us help you get hooked up with the right agencies, get some medications, the antibiotics. Most folks didn't want to do that. At that point, they just wanted to forget it.
After those experiences, Laura decided to get formally trained as a sexual assault nurse examiner. Today, Laura is among a subset of registered nurses who specialize in this kind of care at more than 800 healthcare facilities nationwide.
This way, we have people that choose to do it and are trained to do it well. It's really important.
Now, the hospital where Laura works has new procedures in place to treat victims of sexual assault. It's part of a pilot program called the Safety Center that uses telehealth. The Safety Center is operated out of Penn State's College of Nursing through a grant from the Department of Justice. Here's how it works. When a sexual assault victim comes to the hospital, Laura calls the Safety Center. She gets connected with an expert-level sexual assault nurse who's typically based in an urban area and has seen hundreds of patients. Think of the relationship like a senior doctor advising a less experienced physician about the best course of action. So they chat on the screen, and then Laura wheels the telemonitor down the hallway into the exam room.
So then we both go into the room together, and I bring them all of the equipment we need. I introduce, this is my partner, and she's been doing this for 7 years.
Laura gets the patient's consent, of course, and usually there's also an advocate in the room to provide any extra support. But before Laura does the pelvic exam, she asks the patient to describe what happened and writes down the details. And just a warning, the questions are pretty tough.
Did they kiss you? Where did they kiss you? Where did they place their penis? I mean, we have to ask each individually. Legally, we have to. When we're through with that and that part's done, they can really take a breath.
The patient's experience at the hospital can take up to about 6 hours. And during the actual pelvic exam, photographs must be taken to include in the state's sexual assault evidence collection kit.
This is how we take the pictures, with a little button.
It's like a handheld.
Handheld button. The patient actually gets the button because we're doing a pelvic exam with gloves on. When we're ready to take the picture, we say, can you snap the photo? And they snap it. They are part of the process, and they don't mind doing it. And I think it gives them some sense of control, you know, that they're involved in the whole process of getting their evidence collected.
Doing this work with real-time support from expert-level sexual assault nurses could be a game-changer for many nurses trying to care for patients while collecting evidence. The hospital's chief nursing officer, Matt Romania, says before this program, evidence collected by the hospital often didn't hold up.
As we come to find out, a lot of it wasn't submissible because we weren't doing it in a manner that was
Correct. So that led us to question, is this a service that we can offer? We have to, but is this a service that will be best offered at a place that's better prepared? And then you come to the question, you know, do we transfer these people? After going through this, do you transfer them like an hour away? That's not serving our community well, right?
The program also addresses another concern, burnout among sexual assault nurses, especially for ER nurses who have no formal training or support whatsoever.
So on average, a sexual assault nurse burns out in about a year.
That's Faith Mong. She's the clinical education and training coordinator for the Safety Center. And as part of the pilot, Safety checks in with local ER nurses after each case they handle. Faith says providing ongoing support and assessment to these nurses is essential.
So it's an ever-revolving door that nurses are coming in. We're training them because it's almost like the CSI effect, where they think, oh, this is a really cool field of nursing. I want to get into it. You get to do swabs and evidence collection and deal with crime, and it's really something fascinating to people. But then they get in and they see that it's more than just a rape kit, right? It's more than just this box of swabs and you're collecting. It's a person. It's a person that something bad has just happened to them, and you're the one that has to start picking up the pieces to help them continue on with their life.
That story was reported by Stephanie Marudas of Kuvenda Media. You can hear more of Stephanie's stories on a new podcast called At the Core of Care. We're talking about how nursing is changing, and we asked around. We wanted to hear from nurses. Tell us what you do. What are some of your daily challenges? Several nurses told us that communication is a major part of their job, not just with patients, but with their families.
My name is Nick Johnson. I am a nurse in the neuro ICU. Typically, we see brain bleeds, subarachnoid hemorrhages and intracranial hemorrhages, as well as ischemic stroke from clots. We do see them in a very hyper acute and very early stages of brain injury a lot of the time. And when you do work with the families, they often are asking, what's the prognosis? You know, what does this look like down the line? Is my family member going to recover? Are they going to be the same again? And for the most part, we don't really know, just because it's so early post brain injury. And it's impossible to predict how much somebody's going to recover.
We also heard from Allison. She's a pediatric oncology nurse.
The most challenging part of my job is the days when you have a new diagnosis and being a part when the family is told that, you know, their child has some sort of cancer, or, you know, the conversations where there's not much more we can do and trying to move to end of life, or being a part when, you know, we're going to give your child this drug, but it has a myriad of side effects that go along with it. Being part of those conversations is definitely challenging because, you know, their whole life is getting uprooted. However, it's also the most rewarding at times because you get to develop trust, you get to develop relationships with these families and be able to help make a difference, whether it's the smallest thing you can imagine or, you know, it was just being there and, you know, you were really helping them get through it.
That's our show for this week. The Pulse is a production of WHYY in Philadelphia. Our health and science reporters are Alan Yu, Liz Tung, and Jad Slayman. Nina Feldman contributed reporting for this week's episode. Charlie Kyer is our engineer. Xavier Lopez is our associate producer. Lindsay Lazarski is our producer. I'm Mike and Scott. Thank you for listening.
Behavioral Health Reporting on the Pulse is supported by the Thomas Scattergood Behavioral Health Foundation, an organization that is committed to thinking, doing, and supporting innovative approaches in integrated healthcare. WHYY's Health and Science Reporting is supported by a generous grant from the Public Health Management Corporation's Public Health Fund. PHMC gladly supports WHYY and its commitment to the production of services that improve our quality of life.